Pilots have seen things most people will only dream of. Your host, Jeff Lively, has had his fair share of time in the sky and has plenty of stories to tell. Here on Leaders of Aviation, we're speaking with others in the aviation industry to get their insight and inspiration. Together, we'll gain knowledge to pursue our goals. Life's a journey. Enjoy the flight.
All right. What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Leaders of Aviation podcast. Super excited for today's guest, Miss Lauren Jones. She is a CFII, an MEI, a UPS flight path intern, and also a recent Baylor University graduate. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Absolutely. I'm very excited that we finally found time to make this happen. I know your schedule is quite hectic. And so I'm excited to also, kind of dive deeper into that as well.
Oh, most definitely. I know yours has been busy as well. It's so cool to see all you're doing all the time as well.
Thank you. So let's get started. Where did Lauren fall in love with aviation?
Ooh, that's a great question. I fell in love with aviation in my backyard. So I grew up at a grass strip in the northwest side of Houston. And every Saturday morning, I was woken up to airplanes buzzing down the runway, aka my backyard. So it's quite a unique upbringing. I went to kindergarten thinking everyone had an airplane, and was shocked to find out that no one else did when I'd ask, can I come over and fly with your dad? But all in all, my dad has a V-tail Bonanza, so I grew up flying in the back of it. And I'll never forget where I really fell in love with aviation was when I was 4 years old. I finally was big enough to not sit in a car seat in the back, and my dad took me for my first night flight ever up front. I was finally tall enough to where I didn't get hit in the face with the yoke when we rotated, and I just knew in that moment I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to do what my dad does. So my dad flies for fun, but I knew I wanted to fly.
Awesome. So when most kids were trying to get the front seat in the car to school, you were trying to get the front seat of the in an airplane.
Most definitely. That's right.
Awesome. So with your childhood upbringing, you mentioned that your dad was a pilot. So did he, I'm going to guess he had a huge factor in your love for aviation.
Oh, he most definitely did. His whole thing, though, whenever I got older and actually wanted to really start flying, was don't start flying because dad's cool and does it. Do it because you love it. And I'd go, oh, no, dad, like, I really want to do it. And I think it took me going into my later teenage years for him to realize, okay, wow, like, she really wants to do it. It's not just because dad loves it. But he got me into it for sure.
So when did you log your first official hour?
Ooh, that's a good question. My first official hour was in 2012. I had been invited to talk on a podcast called Hangar Talk and went to downtown, and it was this big deal. It was recorded in this tower downtown Houston. I was so excited. And on the show, they gave me a discovery flight. So it was my first official flight lesson when I was 12. So it was an airport in Sugar Land, Texas, and one of the flight schools there went up, and it was my first time actually getting to really fly. Okay. And taxied the airplane, got to use the rudders, did the takeoff. And in that moment, I was like, oh, yes, I can do this. And it was so much fun. I remember we flew over some sort of plant where Hershey Kisses were made or something cool like that. And I was like, oh, man, you can see everything from above and get to fly. So that was my first official hour. And it was in a little paper log book that I still have. And I do plan on bringing airline interviews in the future.
For sure. That's an absolute unique way to stand out.
Yes.
So with growing up around aviation, I know that, you obviously had been flying a lot up until that first hour. When did you officially start your training? Was it with that first discovery flight?
It was not with that first Discovery flight. My first really big bit of training was in 2015. There's a camp called Camp Kanakuk in Branson, Missouri. And they had what was called at the time the Adventure Series. They don't have it anymore. But my dad knew the person in charge of the finances of the camp. And he had emailed my dad like, hey, we're offering this really cool aviation camp this year. Your daughter should come. Like, I know you're a pilot. So I was 15 at the time. And the whole point of it was to solo at the end of the camp. And so I went, and it was 2 weeks of intensive training with planes from Laterno that they flew up and instructors from Laterno University. And so by the end of the 2 weeks, even though I was only 15, my instructor like scooted her seat back and I got to mock solo. And so then when I was 16, I went back to that camp and actually soloed at the camp the next summer when I was 16. And then when I came home from the camp, that's when flight training like really, really started after my first solo. My dad wanted to get an airplane and he had been looking into 150s and 172s. My mom wanted to get just a little 150 because, oh, it's a cute little plane. Lauren can easily put in the hangar and pull it out. But my dad wanted at least a 172 so he could fly in it comfortably with me. And my dad's not a CFI, but he wanted it also for him to enjoy partly too. So exactly. He's like, if we're getting a second airplane, it might as well be something I enjoy as well. And so one of my neighbors, he was my mentor until he passed away when I was 16, the end of 2016. He was in the hospital and had gotten a call from one of his friends that he was going to sell his airplane. This man had built an RV and that had been his focus for the last 10 years or so. And he had a Cardinal RG that was just sitting in Houston Southwest Airport and only flew maybe, I don't want to get it wrong, but it was a very low amount of hours. Like it was 100 hours over 10 years or just a little bit of flying that it had been doing. I guess over the last 10 to 5 years since he had started the RV project. And so my dad was like, okay, if this neighbor is telling us we should look at it, it must be really good. And it wasn't on the market yet, so it wasn't going off with bidding wars or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so my dad got to just go look at it in advance, was like, oh, this is nice. Like this will be good. And I'll never forget the whole reason we were buying a second airplane, partly too, for me to train him was the VTOL Bonanza. The Bonanza's insurance was so high to add me to it. It was going to be thousands of dollars to add a person with like zero flight hours to learn how to fly in it. Because mm-hmm. High performance, retractable, all the nice stuff. So the Cardinal though, once again, it was complex, not high performance, but it did have retractable landing gear. So I will never forget whenever we're buying the Cardinal, my dad always would say he was so excited. He was excited, I think, partly to have another cool airplane to fly too. It was a good excuse for him, but also he was nervous. I could kind of tell where he was like, whatever you do, if we buy this airplane, you are never allowed to forget to put the gear down. And I was always like, yes, sir. Like, I'm not going to forget to put the gear down. Yes, sir. Because there's so many sayings of you forget to put the gear down once, you'll never do it again. But it's like, don't be that person and those sorts of sayings. But his philosophy and my mentor at the time who recommended we get that plane, their philosophy was if you learn how to fly with retractable landing gear, you'll never forget to put the gear down because you're always going to be paranoid looking for it from the start. And I will tell you now, having years of experience in that airplane, that initial check for the gear, check for the gear, check for the gear, I'll still even look for gear in fixed geared aircraft. Just because I'm like, can't forget the gear. And I've caught certain situations 3 or 4 times now where gear hasn't come down.
Uh-oh.
Cardinal or other aircraft. Where it's like, if it's not ingrained, you won't remember.
Yeah.
But that's how we ended up with the Cardinal. And then that's the plane I really used for my flight training.
Gotcha. So you went from private, instrument, commercial, all in the 177.
Not quite. So I did my private in high school. So I did all my training when I was 17, really. And then the summer of 2017, I was getting ready to take my private pilot check ride, had checked off a majority of the requirements, just had solo cross countries left. When I was on a solo over at West Houston Airport, which was a 5-minute flight from my home airport, when the alternator failed in the pattern there. And so flew it home in the plane, like had to go down for maintenance, and it took it 6 months. So then I got my license, did all my solo cross countries over spring break, my senior year of high school, and then took my check ride a couple days after walking the stage for high school graduation for private.
That was a really intense learning moment, huh?
Yes, yes. I have had a lot of learning moments already in life, but it's good. It expands what you should be looking for in your safety mindset going into each flight. But then I went to Baylor starting the fall of 2018, and I did my instrument and commercial under 141 at Texas State Technical College, since Baylor was paired up with them at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I did my CFI started the training in the Cardinal at the end of 2019. And then 2020 happened where everyone got sent home. And so I was able to continue that training at home with my next door neighbor who taught me for private, which is neat. So got to continue that. He taught me in the Cardinal for private, and then he taught me how students are going to kill me in my airplane teaching. So it was really neat. And then I did my commercial multi that summer as well in 2020 with COVID. COVID was a big blessing for me. I was able just to focus on flying, focus on learning how to teach. And I will say, really having focused on lesson plans and how I was going to be as an instructor made all the difference when I came up here working full-time and then instructing. And then I did my double I after I graduated December 2020. Wow. Graduated December 2020, and then I got a double I January 2021, and then I did my MEI. Was blessed to receive a scholarship, the Francesca Norris Scholarship, where I did the MEI jump seating back and forth from Louisville, Kentucky to Houston, Texas.
Nice.
I know, it was so great. For summer of 2021, and took that check ride August 2021. And then I did my seaplane, commercial seaplane, in October of 2021.
Wow, okay. So, a lot to digest there. So with the... You grew up in Houston. So where did Baylor come into the equation?
That's a good question. My mom found Baylor in a Christian magazine at church when I was in seventh grade. I was an eighth grader, and my mom had heard from all the high school moms that it's helpful to know where you want to send your kids to college in advance so they can take the courses and be more planned out in advance to be prepared, I guess, was her thought process. So I toured Baylor when I was in eighth grade. Oh. I know, it was so fun, so wild. And my dad loved it, my mom loved it, I loved it, but I was like, I'm the youngest person here right now, why are we here? And then when I was a junior in high school, at that point I had been struggling with, do I want to do business? Do I want to do something with finance? Do I want to do something in aviation? I was like, I know I want to fly. I'm coming home every single day asking my mom for the airplane keys. So finally she sat me down and she was like, you want to fly every single day. You should do that for your job. And I was like, that's right. That's right. Yes, ma'am. That's true. So at that point we determined business was off the list. We were going to pursue aviation. So at that point, I looked into more aviation colleges, and I actually toured Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona and was like, this just isn't the same as Baylor in terms of feeling at home on campus. I wasn't seeing many women there, which it's was really nice to go to Baylor, where there are a lot of other ladies in the aviation program.
That's awesome. Just, you know, creating more of a community and feeling more at home, especially in the state of Texas, right?
Definitely. And that was the other biggest draw, was I could easily fly home if I ever needed to. My dad could fly up. My mom could drive up, because only 2.5 hours away by driving, and then a 45-minute flight. So it was comforting to know I had that back home.
So while you were going through Baylor, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, UPS Flight Path Program, right? So where did cargo flying even cross your, you know, hey, I might want to do this for my future?
Yeah, so I first interacted with the cargo scene at Oshkosh 2017. I went to Oshkosh as a camper at this program called Girl Venture, which EAA sponsors during Oshkosh every single year, where it's a group of about 100 high school aged girls with mentors. And you get to do a lot of kind of behind the scenes things at Air Venture the whole week. And one of the days, it was Women Venture Day, which is the Wednesday of every single Oshkosh week, and it was the last day of the program in 2017. UPS had flown in for the first time ever, 767, and they had an all-female crew. So they had all 100 of us girls. We all got to go in the cockpit. The public didn't get to go in the cockpit, but we did. And we got to sit in the captain's seat and get pictures and talk to the crew members. And all the lady pilots were so excited and personable and were very inspiring. And like, you can do this too. But up until that point, I had never thought of cargo. I didn't know it existed. I hadn't ever seen it pop up, really. And so walking through the back of the 767, where all the containers get pushed with the latches to hold them down and all the wheels, I was like, this is really cool. But then when I went off to college, it kind of was just in the back of my mind. It never occurred to me that I could be a cargo pilot, because you hear of how hard it is to get hired on at UPS and FedEx. Like, oh, you got to go fly for Delta for 5-6 years plus to even get your foot in the door at the cargo carriers, just because they're small, such a small niche community within the professional aviation industry. And so I thought of it. And then whenever I was flight instructing my last semester of college, I heard the flight school I was instructing at, the owner was going to retire and shut down the school. And it had been my plan to stay in Waco and flight instruct there. And then when he said that, this is kind of at the height of COVID, it's August 2020 through December 2020. I was like, oh my goodness, I need a plan B right now. And so I had made a LinkedIn account and had been scrolling through, and Ameriflight, who had been following and had reached out to a recruiter, because I thought, oh, it'd be great to be at Ameriflight. They're based out of Dallas. I'd be closer to family again. And I had met one of the recruiters in March 2020 at the Women in Aviation Conference that year before everything shut down. And he wasn't calling me back. It's like, oh man, like they're inundated. They were inundated with pilots and applicants. Everyone wanted to be in cargo. And Ameriflight on their LinkedIn page posted hiring classes of one. They posted one in August and one in September. And I saw the one, it was either September, October. I saw the one in September, October. And they said they were part of the UPS Flight Path program. And that's how they got hired. And they got hired as first officers. At the time, I had just hit 500 hours where I met the 135 first officer requirements. So I was like, oh, that's perfect. That's perfect for me. That's where I'm at. And so I immediately Googled UPS Flight Path program, because I was like, what is that? I don't think I've heard of that before. And so scrolling through online, finding, took a little bit of Googling and digging, I found UPS's Flight Path website and was reading the descriptions of the different jobs. And I was like, this is my dream job, my dream company. this is where I want to be. This is it. Like, this is a perfect, I felt like was a perfect fit. And the application was open right then and there. And I was shocked. It's like, okay, I'll put in my application right now. And I heard nothing back for 2 months. I applied beginning of October and didn't hear anything throughout October, November. And I was on a cross country with my student and middle of nowhere, Texas, get a phone call that's a Louisville area code. And I'm like, no way. No way. This has got to be a scam call. I pick it up and it was my phone screening to be interviewed for the flight path program.
How cool is that?
I know. It's just
you'd weight lifted off your shoulders at that time, because just how hard it is.
God, that's right.
That's why, I mean, I've looked into applying as well, and it's really hard to find information. Like, whether it's YouTube videos, whether it's their actual website, I just didn't look hard enough. But at the same time, it's, you know, this is why this interview is super unique too, because I looked on podcasts, I can't find anything UPS flight path, and this is a perfect opportunity because you're going through the program right now.
That's right. That's right. There's not that much out there besides our website, which in my current position, I'm the quality assurance intern for the flight standards department within UPS Airlines. So I get to manage the website right now, which is really cool.
That is awesome. So let's back up to the interview, right? How did that go? And was that the moment that you accepted the position? When did you know you were going to start? So on and so forth.
So I interviewed after I got phone screened. I interviewed about a week afterwards, and the interview was one of the best interviews I've ever had. It was amazing. I had no clue what to expect. When I was interview prepping that whole week, I had no clue what I was really getting into. I couldn't find any information about how UPS conducted interviews, what they were looking for. But whenever going into the interview, everyone was so personable and open. They really wanted to get to know you as a person, as well as a professional, and just how you would contribute to the company, to the flight path program. And then you as a pilot too. It wasn't overly technically oriented. It was just more about your character, what skills you have, and what you can contribute. It was a very good interview. I knew the interview was, it was awesome. It was awesome. So the people on my interview actually became my bosses, wow, which was so cool that I kind of had gotten to see everyone in advance.
Yeah, for sure. And with that application process, like just for, you know, some of the listeners that you know, because now that you've gone and you've become the quality assurance for the website, right? And when beginning there, after that interview, after you knew that you had the position, you know, talk about that transition time. So, you know, you went from wanting to be a flight instructor in Waco, I need a plan B, got the plan B, got hired. So now you're moving to Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how that worked?
Somewhat. So I was interviewing at UPS when I also had been interviewing for a 141 flight school in Houston, which was my dream flight school to work at. And I was blessed to, at the same time, just a day apart from each other, get a job offer from the 141 flight school and a job offer from UPS Airlines.
Wow.
And so I had to politely say, I appreciate, you know, you taking me on and would love to work for you, but UPS called.
Yep.
And so after I had interviewed, it was about 2 weeks, That sounds like a lot. It felt like 2 weeks. It was a week. It was a solid week after I interviewed before I heard back from UPS that I received a position in Louisville, which is the quality assurance intern. So we all work within UPS Airlines in the flight operations office. And so I'm the quality assurance department in the flight training center. Perfect. So
when did you start that? Like what was the date?
So I started February 22nd in 2021 and received the position about mid-December in 2020.
Cool. So now talk a little bit about the flight path. You know, what does it entail? You know, any information out there is very hard to find.
Definitely. So my job, my daily tasks, I have daily tasks. And that's what makes my job unique is some of the jobs are very much just project oriented based off of what office you're in versus my job. We have tasks that are done daily, weekly, quarterly, and then annually. So there's typically always something to be doing. And then if there's more downtime per se during the end of quarters, when we're the busiest right after a quarter ends. So when a quarter's going on, meaning 3 months, sectioned off in the year, you can be involved in other projects. And that's the coolest part about being a flight path intern is you can basically choose to be as involved in different areas of the airline as you want to be. The whole point is for you to get to learn as much as you possibly can about the company, as well as contribute as much as you can while you're there. So my job, I do filing of what we have are called daily operations reports. I do a lot of tracking of our data. That's my biggest thing, is in charge of all the flight training center data. So whenever a crew member goes into what we call the schoolhouse, meaning the training center for training, for whether it's qualification training to get type rated and start working for the airline, or their continuing qualification training. So every single year, each fleet, the crew members have to come in and basically go through a check ride every single year in order to be out flying the line. The MD-11 and the 747, they have to come back every 6 months just due to how the training footprint is laid out. So I get to track all that data and present it to the FAA to maintain our AQP data compliance. So it's cool. So involved with seeing how the FAA audits and what they care about tracking for the airline, as well as how UPS presents the data and information that we collect over the year in different training events. So it's interesting. I get to see causes of failures in some cases, also get to see why crew members are scoring lower on, say, search and training events, but then also the overwhelming majority of just how successful everyone is, but how the training program can target areas of weakness on purpose to try and train people back up to competency for flying the line.
That's really cool. So a lot goes into being an intern. It's honestly what you're describing way more than being an intern.
Right? Yes. Okay. So first off, the misconception that I think a lot of people, when you hear intern, you think, oh, you're going to just pull papers from the coffee machine. You're going to change printer cartridges. You're going to get people coffee. We have full-time jobs is the way that we'll typically put it, where you're just involved and you're engrossed and you are a full-on employee in the airline with legitimate responsibilities for helping the company run. Yeah.
Very cool. And so with the website, I noticed that by the time that you graduate from the program, you have to have 500 hours. Am I saying that wrong?
No, that's correct. That is currently what the program is looking for.
Okay.
It kind of fluctuates based off the industry.
Sure.
But 500 hours is the number where if you currently do not have 500 hours, HR is not going to likely see your resume.
Gotcha. Okay. So with that being said, I noticed, you know, on Instagram, you do a lot of flying still, you know, in the Cardinal. So how do you keep up with flying in that full-time position?
It's a lot sometimes, but it's great. Oh my goodness. So I've instructed up here almost 300 hours and then flown the Cardinal probably about 100 hours and then other planes and other flying about 75 hours or so. So far over my year, I've flown about 500 hours while working full time, which has been a lot, but it's fun. In the moments, week to week, I wouldn't even notice how much I was flying just because I was enjoying it. It was just so fulfilling to go instruct and then have friends say, all right, I need some nighttime. I'm like, okay, well, let's go get you some nighttime. Or someone needs an IPC, and so get to give them an IPC, or just little things like that that would always pop up. There was one week in November. It was the first week in November. One of my bosses kept telling me, the weather is going to be so bad in December and January. You're not going to get to fly at all. And I had the goal at the time to hit 900 hours. And I was like, oh man, I'm not going to do it. And I was stressed about it. In that week, I flew 30 hours in 7 days while working full-time, 40-hour job. Oh, and looking back, I still don't know when I slept, but I know I slept. Yeah. So it just varied week by week. But
that's a lot. I mean, that's a 70-hour work week, essentially.
That's right. So when I had moved up to Kentucky, I wasn't planning on flight instructing. I planned on just fully doing the job, just focusing on my job. But it was very clear when I came up here is that whenever you left the office, laptop closed, you're off the clock, like you should be off the clock. You're not doing UPS things. So I'd come home and be like, oh my goodness, I miss flying. I miss instructing, because I had done it for a couple months at that point, where I missed instructing. I missed the light bulb moments. I missed the like smiles when someone landed really well for the first time and connecting with people on discovery flights. And so I went to a Women in Aviation event up here, and one of the ladies working on, we were doing projects like woodworking, and the lady across from me was a flight instructor at one of the local flight schools. And she texted the owner of the flight school, he's a UPS captain. And she goes, I have a UPS intern right here. She'd be a great fit. And boom, I walked out of there with a job after 2 weeks of being in Louisville.
That's awesome. So yeah, that was going to be my next question. So with the flight instructing, with the flight school owner, he's also a UPS pilot. So, you know, how has that been? I know you said 300 hours, you know, so how many students have you had during the time that you've been at UPS?
Good question. So when I first started at the flight school, it was co-owned by a UPS captain and then another gentleman. And the UPS captain, about halfway through my time at the flight school, still there, but halfway through me being there, he sold his shares to the other gentleman just because he was so involved with other facets of aviation at the airport. He's been mentoring mechanics, so helping raise the next generation of mechanics, and just got very busy again with UPS flying. So sadly he had to shift his focus in that way, but he's still been a wonderful mentor to me. Oh my goodness, he's wonderful. But the now owner, full owner of the flight school I work at, he's been awesome as well. Oh my goodness. So I started off in April just doing about two or three discovery flights, and none of them panned out to students, where I was like, okay, like that was fun. And I could tell they just wanted to go up for a ride, like, oh, my wife bought me this plane ride, basically, or, you know, this lesson. I just want to circle the house and show the kids, you know. And I was like, okay, perfect. So did about three of those. And then things really started to pick up in May, whenever just getting settled and building your own reputation as a flight instructor, I think is the biggest thing when you're Part 61 flight instructing, is being known for your teaching style and that you're looking for students, and how just getting involved in the community wherever you are is the biggest thing, I'd say. So over my time, over the year, I've probably flight instructed. I have a chart, and I think I have flown with at least 26 different people.
Awesome.
So some of them discovery flights, some of them were students. Out of the 26, I think 15 of them have been full-on students.
So that's still on top of your 40 hours a week. That's a lot.
It is a lot. Right now, I have 8 students. So
very cool.
Which is still a lot. I will say whenever it gets closer to 10, you're like working 40 hours, is like, oh, well, it's going to be a lot. But
talk about how do you balance that? You know, that 8 students is still a lot, especially with the full-time position.
Oh, most definitely. Google Calendar. Google Calendar started to save my life. I was a big physical planner person, and I found I wasn't physically home enough. I was just basically home just to sleep every night, to where I couldn't update my calendar to know what was going on the next day. So I made a very good color code system on my calendar where work is red, flights are purple, and fun flying is blue. And then anything fun in my life was yellow or pink. So that was my biggest way, was just to lay out my schedule and say, okay, I have a 2-hour flight block here I can do. All right, I better eat for 30 minutes here, and just somewhat plan out my life a little bit more. But then you can't predict things like weather. So let's say it was a rainy day. Instead of doing a ground, if a student didn't need a ground, that would be my time to go grocery shop or do my laundry. So just trying to fit in your basic needs whenever you could.
For sure. Absolutely. So what is the, so you mentioned, or I guess you haven't mentioned yet, the Flight Path program is a 1-year program, correct?
Yes.
So February, and you're coming up on a year, aren't you?
I know. I am done February 22nd, so I only have 19 days left, and I'm very sad about it, but I'm very excited too. So at the end of our year, you go to AmeriFlight. Most interns do that. That is the laid out program. Part of the flight path is to go fly for AmeriFlight and fly for 1,500 turbine PIC hours before coming back to UPS.
Okay.
So if you go through the program and you're a good intern, and then you contribute to AmeriFlight and get your flight time, AmeriFlight pays for your ATP through them, and then UPS is guaranteeing that you get a first officer interview.
That's awesome.
They do not guarantee you the job, but they do guarantee you the interview. And the first 3 interns to have interviewed have all come back. So, and it's just this constant rolling
It sounds like they have it down pretty good.
They do. It's really neat to see the whole program working.
Very cool. So with AmeriFlight, do you know where you're going to be based, and, you know, or do you have to apply for a base, or, you know, what does that look like?
So with AmeriFlight, they typically just tell you where you're going to go. You can try to say where you'd like to be, but it mainly is just wherever they have openings, wherever they need you the most, that's where you'll be. So most of the interns find out about a month before they leave their internship where they're going to be based. And then, so about a month before you go to AmeriFlight, but you shouldn't sign leases until you're off of OE, your operating experience, because they can move you wherever they need you. But all the bases at AmeriFlight, I've heard really good things about from the people at the different options. So it's part of the adventure of being a pilot.
Absolutely.
Finding out where you're going to be.
For sure. So I mean, that's kind of exciting too, right?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I've heard I'm probably going to be on the West Coast.
Okay.
Past that, unsure. Either Burbank, Ontario, Portland, or Spokane. So.
Are those more needed bases, or that's just what it is right now?
They're needed right now. So yeah. It can fluctuate a good bit. Some of the most popular bases in Ameriflight are Puerto Rico, so San Juan, Barrinken, and then another very popular base is Dallas, Texas.
Of course.
So,
the one that I assumed you would want. Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm up for the adventure of trying something very different than Texas. I've enjoyed living in a different city for a year here in Louisville. I've fallen in love with Louisville, to where I'm excited for some change too.
Absolutely. So with that next step, will you be a first officer for Ameriflight, a captain? You know, how does that look? Cause when I look at Ameriflight and their job postings, all I see is captain positions available. I don't see any first officer positions.
Yes, yeah, so Ameriflight, they post their captain positions because that's what they really are always in need of. The first officer positions, they reserve them for essentially the flight path interns. They do have a program with Aviate, but I haven't really heard of many people at Aviate doing. I don't know much about that side of Ameriflight, but I do know they reserve the first officer positions for UPS Flight Path and for United Aviate. Most of the UPS interns, prior to my cohort of interns, they all came in with 200, 250 hours, and they had to fly up to 500 hours. So they only had to fly about 200 hours, 250, to be able to go to Ameriflight for first officer minimums. And flying 200 hours, 250 hours is a lot with a full-time job, but they were all able to do it. And so at the time, that's what the program was kind of laid out as. But due to COVID, it kind of pushed, I think, higher time applicants to the flight path, and it has continued to do so. So especially as the program has grown. Most of us who have come in, we come in with more like 600 hours roughly. And so depending on how much you build or how much you had coming in, about a majority of them do still go in as first officers to Ameriflight.
Gotcha.
So they'll reserve the E-120s for UPS flight path interns because UPS likes to see that crewed experience. So working in a crewed environment, it's an SIC type rating. So it shows that you can work really hard and pass a type rating course. In the Brasilia, I've heard from interns, it's just this awesome airplane to fly, which is so cool. But I am going to go in as a captain at 1,200 hours. So right now I'm trying to build my time up to there. When I first came in the flight path, I was all excited. I was like, I'm going to fly the Brasilia. Gonna be so much fun. I'm gonna be a first officer. And then when I was instructing so much, I just got engrossed in instructing and then had more and more students where I was just spending all my time at the airport. And before I knew it, I was just closer and closer and closer to 1,000 hours where I was like, whoa, I could potentially go in as a captain. So that's what I'm choosing to do.
Very cool. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
With becoming a captain, how long do you have to be at Ameriflight? And then, I guess, because I've read through the website where it's like 36 months or something on average, and then you have the potential to flow through to UPS.
Yes. So Flight Path 1, the way it works is when you're on Ameriflight, it takes roughly 3 to 4 years for interns to go back to UPS. So going in as a first officer, you'll probably spend about a year on the E-120 or whichever other aircraft they might put you on. They could put you on the Metroliner or the 99 or 1900 as first officer to observe. The E-120, though, is, since it's dual crew, they both pilots get to log the time. So that's why they'll also put you there. So typically about a year on the E-120 and then about 3 years as a captain is what it's looked like so far. And then if you go in directly as a captain, you're immediately building to the 1500 turbine PIC time requirement to come back. So once again, though, 3 to 4 years. So just depends when UPS calls back.
Hey, Lauren, time to go.
Well, also when you're on a merit flight, the whole point too is to really focus on the company. So, and make it a great place that it is and contribute and be the best employee you possibly can be there. And also growing as a pilot, especially doing single pilot operations. Oh my goodness. It's going to be a big learning curve, for but sure. I'm excited for it.
Absolutely. So on your Instagram too, I've noticed some flight simulation times. Is it the 57 and 67?
Mm-hmm. I posted the 757, 767. I have a post up where that one's the MD-11, where it's just a full-on post. But part of my job too was something that I got to get involved with, which I'm so, so grateful I got to do, is simulator tours. So I've gone to give over 17 simulator tours to UPS customers and other people who UPS, let's say, has an upper level manager who they'd like to mentor. And so they get to come in and see the simulators. So I get to run the simulators and basically give a discovery flight.
Wow.
An MD-11, a 767, 75. So it's been really awesome. I have about 120 hours in the simulators.
Wow.
So I'm qualified to operate the 747-1 A300, all the 75s we have in Louisville, so the three sims, and then the 767, and then both MD-11 sims we have in Louisville.
That's incredible. It's very fun. So with those tours, I mean, obviously you had to learn. So was there like a little ground school that you had to do, or what was that?
Good question. So for each individual sim, you have to learn how to operate the instructor station. That's the biggest thing. So for example, the MD-11, it's very automated. It is so automated. It's awesome. I love the MD-11. But with that, each of the instructor stations are different for the simulators is the biggest thing. So some of the instructor stations will talk to the flight management computers, the FMCs or the FMSs, and will update weights and speeds automatically for you, whereas other simulators won't. So knowing, all right, what's my rotation speed in the 7.5 versus the MD-11 today? Oh, I'm in the 7.4. What's my VREF plus 5 in this one? So knowing your way around the FMCs, especially in advance for giving tours, you should really know your speeds. And we have these nice checklists. So essentially a simulator user guide that us interns, we have all made, which walk you through starting up, shutting down, and then in flight, your numbers. But we get to spend so much time in the simulators for the purpose of being prepared for the simulator tours that it's natural. It's kind of like flying other things. So we also, though, on that note, we do get to go through an aircraft ground school. Okay. So I chose, my boss was so awesome, and she allowed me to choose what ground school I wanted to do. And I chose to do the 747 because that's my dream airplane, to fly a 747 one day. And so get to go through the training footprint with the new higher class. So my class of 74 people had 6 people on the first day, 6 or more. And then there were 4 that got to stay in Louisville. And then the others went to Anchorage to train after their welcome day. Cool. And so the 7-4, it was a long bit. We go as an intern through the whole aircraft systems ground school for that aircraft. And then after the knowledge validation, that's where we kind of stop per se. We could choose to go on and do procedures training with the crews, but unless you're a fleet intern, meaning assigned to that particular fleet, so the 7576 office or the A300 office or the MD-11 office, at that point, it's not paid. But it's really good experience too if you're allowed to sit in on it. But we're required to go through an aircraft systems class. So the A300, for example, it's a 3-day ground school for that. And then boom, you take the knowledge validation versus the MD-11. It's about a week. 757, 767, about a week. The 741 I have to sit on was 2 full weeks.
Wow.
So we had in the classroom days, and then kind of intermixed in it, which was neat, was some of the flows. So using paper trainers, so the panels, the overhead, the center pedestal, and then your PFDs and your whole cockpit posters to practice your flows. But the main part is really knowing the systems of the airplane. What was neat about the 7-4 was in that period before the knowledge validation, we got to learn how to pre-flight. So me as an intern, the 4 crew members in my class, one was an A350 captain for another major airline. One other was a 777 captain for a major airline. And then another was a 747 captain from another airline. And then there is one lady that was, she flew Airbuses. So she had flown larger Airbuses too.
That's which is really you know, a lot of aircraft are covered in there, or at least, you know, a lot of knowledge is held between those people.
Definitely, definitely. And the biggest thing too was their international experience. So then with larger aircraft where they're going overseas and have experience with those procedures, that's why UPS will put them on the 7-4, for example. So getting to hear their stories was so cool.
That's so awesome. I mean, that's you know, soon your future, right?
That's right. Hopefully so.
Very cool. Starting to wrap things up here. What has been, you know, during your flight training, and I know you recently passed 1,000 hours, and I know you're going to get that 1,200 coming up very soon. Congrats on that. I know you have a lot of experiences. Is there one particular flight that stands out to you over your 1,000 hours?
In terms of an emergency or just in general?
One of your more memorable ones.
More memorable. So I think a flight I will never forget was my first solo ever in the Cardinal, the gear didn't come down.
Wow.
So that is definitely the most memorable flight of my life.
So let's walk through that one. Your first solo and the gear didn't come down. What did you do?
So I had done 2 circuits around the pattern, full stop taxi backs, and then I was up on my third, and it was a towered airport. There was no one else there. My instructor on the ground with a walkie-talkie, and he had been recording me the whole time on his cell phone. I'm on downwind. I put the gear down when I'm abeam midfield like I always do because it takes 14 seconds to come down, so I wanted to give it time. I'm abeam the numbers, and I do my GUMPS checks. Gas. Look down. I don't see a wheel. I look at the light. There's no yellow light and no green light, so no up or no down. And then the gear handle is obviously down. I'm looking at my 4-landing checklist. I'm like, well, the gear is not down. So I'm like, and I had already pulled the power back a little bit with the gear. And then I hear the gear warning horn going off, and I'm just kind of turning base final. And as I'm on base to final, I'd already been cleared to land and read it back. I go, Houston Executive Tower, Cardinal 177 Delta Whiskey, going around, gear not coming down. And my flight instructor, the video you've been taking, it goes from me, boom, his feet, and he just starts walking. And immediately gets on the radio and goes, what do you mean the gear's not coming down? And I'm like, It's not coming down. So I pulled off in the pattern, and I've been doing right traffic, pulled off, was doing right 360, and my flight instructor was talking me through, all right, just cycle it, because I was pulling out the POH, getting ready to pump it down. And so it took 6 cycles for the gear to come down.
Goodness.
And we had decided if it didn't come down on the A cycle, I was going to pump it. Well, later when we looked at the cause of the issue, there had been a swivel valve that had been leaking hydraulic fluid. So even if I tried to pump it, if enough of it had leaked out, there wouldn't have been any fluid to build the pressure up in the system.
Wow.
Because that's what hand pumping it does.
Yeah.
Is pumps it down and locks it. So I was very blessed that there was still enough hydraulic fluid. And I will never forget the whining noise that electrically operated hydraulic power pack that in the back was making. It was like, and I was watching the wheel just slowly move. And it's like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. Cause it would have been worse if it got stuck, not fully extended, cause it would just been dragging behind, and just see the wheel come up. And then you feel like clunk, clunk, the gear locking. So the plane kind of shakes. And I was so excited. Oh my goodness. But I learned from that experience, and I've taken it on each time from there. Calm, cool, and collected. All the other emergencies I've dealt with since then, it's like, oh, flaps are stuck at 30 degrees position. We're just going to keep trekking back to the airport. Or gear doesn't come down. That's no problem. We have tons of fuel. We'll pull off. We'll pump it. Those sort of situations. Whenever you're in those, level-headed and take your time. There's no reason to rush.
very cool. Thank you for sharing that. So if the listeners want to connect with you, what are some good places that they can do that?
I can be reached through my Instagrams. I have an account called LaurenFly1, the number one, and then LaurenFly2.0, so LaurenFly2.0. That's my aviation Instagram.
Very cool. Well, I do want to thank you for your time today. And if there is, I'm starting to ask every guest at the end of the podcast, if there is one leadership principle that you could leave with the listeners today, what would that be?
The first thing that popped to mind was teamwork, but also integrity. So both of those, I think, are the two biggest characteristics that I've seen in action that just makes such a big difference in a place of work or any scenario where you have leadership. Integrity, it can encompass so much, so many other principles as well. Just acting the best you can and morally sound when you lead your people, and then being a good team player, building into teamwork, because that's a big key to get things done. CRM.
Yes, CRM. Love it. Mm-hmm. Well, again, Lauren, thank you so much for your time today. We'll have to do another episode when you're in and at AmeriFlight, and also one day when you are soon to be at UPS.
I look forward to that. Most definitely. Thank you so much for having me. I love getting to share my experiences with you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. And until next time.
Thank you for tuning into the Leaders of Aviation podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing.